It is Monday, September 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States and Russia have not yet reached an agreement on a Syria ceasefire. Anti-Beijing lawmakers win seats in Hong Kong elections. We'll hear from one of them.
We could see that the Communist Party has no respect to Hong Kong's civic society.
And there's a sport for the blind that will factor in Rio's Paralympics. It's all ahead. President Barack Obama says he had productive talks with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, on Syria, but that the two sides have yet to reach an agreement on a ceasefire deal that would allow more humanitarian aid into the war-ravaged country. Obama spoke to reporters at the close of the Group of 20 Nations Leaders Summit in Hangzhou, China. He'd earlier met with Putin. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, whose government support opposing sides, were unable to reach another cessation of hostilities to allow greater humanitarian access to besieged areas. On the ground, Syrian government forces and their allies have laid siege again to rebel-held districts of the city of Aleppo, while Turkey proclaimed its border area in northern Syria cleared of Islamic State fighters. Turkey has also gone after Kurdish fighters who have been backed by the U.S. in the battle against the IS group. Obama spoke about the ongoing talks with the Russians on a range of issues, including the Syrian jihadist group known as the Nusra Front.
And we're back into a situation in which Assad's regime is bombing with impunity. That, in turn, we think is actually strengthening the capacity of Nusra to recruit people who might not have initially been sympathetic to terrorism, but now view anyone who's fighting against Assad as legitimized. And that is a very dangerous dynamic. We have had some productive conversations about what a real cessation of hostilities would look like that would allow us both, the United States and Russia, to focus our attention on common enemies like ISIL and Nusra. Given the gaps of trust that exist, that's a tough negotiation. And we haven't yet closed the gaps in a way where we think it would actually work. But my instructions to Secretary Kerry and Mr. Putin's instructions to Mr. Lavrov was to keep working at it over the next several days.
Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales tells International Edition's Victor Beatty Turkey's 10-day intervention has complicated what has become a truly international conflict.
Turkey's involvement with its two-pronged approach, one attacking the Kurds and one attacking the Islamic State, further complicates the situation along the border. I hope what it means is that the Turks have finally abandoned reasonably active support, indirect and direct support for Islamic State, and that will be a major blow to their ability to rearm and to get personnel through. So that'll be very important. The troops the fighters that are working with the Turks are variously described as secular and Islamist groups, and I suspect that a number of those groups are only marginally better than Islamic State in terms of their respect of human rights. So there's a problem there. The Turks have the best capacity of anybody, I suppose, in the region, including the US in this respect, because they've got everything there, a very large and well-trained armed forces, the Air Force, their armor, that sort of thing, which they can bring to bear. So that's a very significant contribution. But as I say, the Kurdish element is a real complication.
Is the 10-day Turkish offensive in northern Syria, is it over?
This remains to be seen. Islamic State has this ability to be driven out of an area and then pop back in again. And they can either just concentrate on making raids or they can actually try something more substantial. And it depends, I suppose, on how important the border area is to Islamic State.
There are also reports that government forces from Damascus and their allies have laid siege again to rebel-held eastern Aleppo Sunday. This has been a real seesaw battle for this city, and it's an important battle.
I think a lot of people were surprised that when the government's first siege a few weeks ago was fairly quickly broken, the U.S. and Russia were engaged in negotiations to try to come up with what I think is the essential thing in the whole process, a political agreement between the two of them as to how this thing was going to be stopped. And that seems to have fallen apart. And as that's happened, the Russians, I think, have increased their support for the Syrian government. And now we're seeing the siege being reimposed.
Anthony Billingsley said he believes it's up to the Americans and Russians to tell their respective allies they're ending their support. He believes that's the only way to grind combat operations to a halt and enable diplomacy to take over. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, the G20 is trending, but it's a particular photo that's trending. They do every time they have one of these meetings what they call a family photo, where they get everyone together and they take a nice group picture. And people always try to analyze from this photo and see what it means, who's standing near who, and what all of these geopolitical elements can be ascertained merely by the photo setup. And social media has added a new element to this because you have everyone kind of speculating. And sometimes these photos go viral. Now, case in point, this year you have one of these family photo moments where you see Presidents Putin and Erdogan kind of speaking to each other. It looks like they're whispering to each other. And President Obama at the other end of the family photo kind of staring down the way saying, what are they talking about? Now, I don't know what President Obama exactly was looking at in that photo, but a lot of people are saying it's a funny little moment. And the one thing I keep seeing over and over again, people say, what caption would you give this photo? How would you caption this? So a lot of people analyzing that today on the internet. Also trending today, hashtag Freddie70, because today would have been Freddie Mercury's 70th birthday. As we were talking about just before we went on, it's hard to imagine these celebrities that die at an early age, what they would be like today. So a lot of people trying to speculate that. And also trying to remember Freddie Mercury from back in the day, that Live Aid concert that Queen did, which is one of the best concerts, rock concerts or rock performances ever, in a lot of people's opinion. And Freddie Mercury and his memory is getting quite an honor. They're naming an asteroid after him.
Ah.
So that's a nice way to commemorate the day as well. And then finally, hashtag Labor Day. It is Labor Day here in the U.S. and other parts of the world. So it marks the unofficial end of summer and the beginning of fall and back to school. But a lot of people, in addition to noting those things on social media, are talking about things like workers' rights and minimum wage and fair working hours. So they're using it to kind of send a message today and also to celebrate people who don't get a day off, including first responders and even parents. There's no day off from being a parent, as my parents often told me when I was growing up. So happy Labor Day to everyone out there, the hard workers out there all around the world.
Absolutely, and parents as well. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Islamic State claims Syria explosions that have killed dozens of people. North Korea fires three ballistic missiles off its eastern coast. A suicide attack in Kabul kills 24, more than 90 are wounded. And in the U.S., early voting begins in September. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
For the last 8 months, NASA's Dawn mission has been studying Ceres, the largest object in the asteroid belt, from a relatively low altitude. The spacecraft is currently sitting about 385 kilometers above the dwarf planet's surface. Over that time, the space probe has been sending a large quantity of data and images back to Earth, providing much-needed insight into the giant asteroid. Now, NASA wants to move Dawn from its low orbit to an altitude of about 1,460 kilometers to get a whole new look at Ceres. The U.S. Space Agency says that Dawn's prime mission ended back on June 30th and that it had beaten all of its scientific goals at Ceres and another dwarf planet, Vesta. NASA has since extended Dawn's mission so that it can continue to study the giant asteroid, but from a new and different perspective. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the Rio Paralympics will include goalball, and we'll hear all about it. A new generation of lawmakers bent on preserving Hong Kong's autonomy against increasing interference from China is heading to victory in the territory's parliamentary elections. Final results show pro-democracy candidates won 30 of 70 seats in the Legislative Council. Among the winners in Sunday's Legislative Council elections was 23-year-old Nathan Law, one of the leaders of the 2014 protests, student-led pro-democracy umbrella revolution, which shut down key parts of Hong Kong for 79 days, demanding for full and free elections. Law and fellow protest leader Joshua Wong co-founded the party Democisto, which advocates a citywide referendum on independence from Beijing. The two were convicted last month for their roles in leading the protests, but received light sentences. I spoke with Law, who is the youngest person ever elected to the council. He described his reaction to his election victory.
Well, actually, it is quite surprised because I was originally thinking myself fighting for the last seats of the constituency, but turns out I became the second highest vote candidate. So I'm a bit surprised, but it also tells, oh, there would be more pressure and responsibility for me because more and more people supporting me and putting their trust on me. So I will try to enhance myself and try to perform the best.
Now, in this election, this was the highest turnout in any legislative elections since the handover when Britain returned control of Hong Kong to China in 1997. What do you think that says?
Well, it says that people are getting used to voice out with their votes, and they are really upset with the poor governance now. As you can see, like, this term of election, the voting rate is the highest, especially in Hong Kong Island. For me, I provide a new choice for all the voters, and they have more motivation to come out and vote. And the vote is also a symbol about of them, which they don't agree, they don't like the current governance.
Some Hong Kong voters, were they worried about casting their ballots? Were there reports of harassment by perhaps pro-Beijing forces in Hong Kong?
Yeah, actually, I've been receiving a lot of information about there will be harassment from the pro-Beijing camp and also from the ones they hired. And actually, for me, during the whole election campaign, I got a lot of unreasonable delay. And for example, my data for mail is being blocked because of me talking about like self-determination. So these things are the ways the pro-Beijing camp use and the government use to lower your winning rates.
Well, going forward, and once you join the council, how do you and your colleagues, how will you move forward now as far as dealing with Beijing?
Yeah. For me and for Democisto, we insist that the conversation between Hong Kong civic society and Beijing has to be based on the mutual respect. And we could see that the Communist Party has no respect to Hong Kong civic society. So it is really unlikely that we will launch like dialogue with them on this basis. But once if there is signal about like, well, there will be mutual respect, then everything could start again.
Nathan Law, who's won election to Hong Kong's Legislative Council. U.S. President Barack Obama wrote Monday in an open letter to workers across the country as the U.S. celebrates Labor Day that when workers raise their voices for a fair wage and dignity in the workplace, they sustain the story of America. Labor Day became an official American holiday in 1894. It's observed on the first Monday in September. The president said if he were looking for a job today that would allow him to build some security for his family, that he would join a union. While the membership rosters of labor unions have been falling steadily for the past 30 years, workers' benefits the unions fought for decades ago are now customary in most U.S. workplaces, including five-day work weeks, health care insurance, and vacations paid for by employers. Many union members now work for local, state, and federal governments in white-collar jobs and not in the factories where the labor movement began. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Fresh off the Olympic Games, Brazil now hosts the Paralympic Games. Well over 4,000 athletes from more than 160 countries will travel to Rio. The USA is sending its largest team ever to the Paralympics. 289 athletes are packing up to fly south to compete in sports such as wheelchair rugby, sitting volleyball, and goalball. What's goalball? We sent correspondent Tom Banza to find out about this sport designed specifically for people with limited or no eyesight.
Quiet, please. Play.
The three players on each goalball team position themselves in front of their net, which stretches across the back line of the volleyball-sized court. One player takes the 1.5-kilo medicine ball and rockets it low across the court. The ball has bells inside of it that jingle. That's because goalball athletes are all blind or visually impaired. Defenders crouch, reach, slide, or lunge when they hear the ball coming at them. The court is marked off with tactile lines made with masking tape over string so the players can feel where they are. I asked seven-time U.S. Paralympian Jen Armbruster of Portland what sport goalball is most similar to.
Reverse dodgeball.
Reverse dodgeball? I thought of dodgeball, too.
Yeah, reverse dodgeball.
In dodgeball, the object is to avoid the thrown ball. Here in goalball, the defending team puts their bodies in the way of the ball, aimed at the wide goal behind them.
Said it's a much heavier ball going a lot faster. But yeah, your defense is very much a soccer goalie. You know, you're defending and using your body to defend it, and then the underhand motion is like a softball pitcher. You know, it's underhand or sidearm because it's got to be low.
High ball!
Armbruster says she transitioned to goal ball from basketball in her teens when optic nerve degeneration gradually took her eyesight. She says she loves team sports and the team experience.
Being part of a team is usually what draws a lot of people in. It's just that feeling of, like, I do belong here. This is a sport that I can play, and I can play with my sighted friends because guess what? I can slap a blindfold on them and take them out here.
Armbruster's teammate, Ileana Mason, is a senior at Portland State University. Mason says she was introduced to goalball at a sports camp for visually impaired kids during high school.
I honestly wasn't that into goalball at first. Then my first practice, they just kind of like hammered me with balls. And afterwards, I kind of looked at my dad and I was like, you know, I don't know if I really like this. Like,
she was a gymnast and I saw her and said, hey, you're athletic. You really should try. And she's like, yeah, okay, whatever.
I just wanted to do handstands on the court.
Mason was born with cataracts and glaucoma, giving her blurry vision. Because goalball players have varying levels of sight, they all wear blackout eye masks, so everyone is equally blind on the court. Mason says the competitive aspects of the game eventually hooked her.
I just fell in love with the sport. We play it so much that, like, you have dreams about playing the sport. Like, after a training camp, I'll, like, wake up with my hands in the air, like, trying to block a ball in my sleep.
Goalball was invented in Europe right after World War II to help blinded veterans stay active. It's now played worldwide. It became a medal event at the Paralympic Games in 1976. 10 women's and 10 men's goalball teams qualified for this year's games in Rio de Janeiro. The U.S. women may be tested by Canada, Turkey, China, and Japan. The Japanese women won gold in London in 2012. Russia will not be at the Rio Games because their entire Paralympic team was excluded due to doping allegations.
Quiet, please. Center.
Spectators have to be quiet during matches so the players can hear the ball, which might make things interesting in Brazil, where the fans have a boisterous reputation. The troubled economy in the host city and country has forced budget cutbacks and consolidation of Paralympic Games venues, but all planned sports will still be contested. Five-time Paralympian Asia Miller says she followed the Olympic Games in Rio to get a sense of what she's in for.
I'm not expecting to go down there to stay in a five-star resort. I know that, you know, so I don't, you know, I'm going down there to play. I'll deal with whatever's thrown at me while I'm there, but I'm really going down there to play.
The U.S. women entered the Rio Paralympics as the defending world champions in goalball. Their first game is against host country Brazil on September 8th. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Portland, Oregon.
On that look at the upcoming Paralympics. Well, that's our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. We have a whole range of all kinds of news, all kinds of stories, feature news, all kinds of things. Please look at that. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
An editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the first Monday of September every year, America pauses to honor its workers and the contributions they make to our nation's strength and prosperity. The notion that work is valued and even noble dates to the ancients. "Seest thou a man diligent in his labor?" the book of Proverbs asks. "He shall stand before kings." In the United States, the belief goes back well over a century. As a holiday, the Labor Day celebration began in the 1880s in New York City with an effort by labor unions to demonstrate the numbers, strength, and spirit of working men and women. They organized parades and rallies and used the demonstrations to press for new laws to benefit workers, such as standardizing the 8-hour workday. The movement spread to other cities, and in 1894, Congress made it a national holiday honoring all American workers. The association with trade and labor unions has declined over the years. Today, for most people, the holiday represents the last long weekend of summer, a time to relax and spend time with family and friends. There are still parades and rallies, particularly in election years, and also sporting events and picnics. For many, Labor Day means a no Labor Day before the change of seasons and start of a new school year. Over time, work in the U.S. itself has changed. More Americans now are occupied in offices and services than who toil on the factory floor. The connection between the holiday and the nation's workers remains real, though, as recognition of the source of so much of America's economic and social achievements.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA. VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.